Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, our reporter Sue Jones. Headphones that make you deaf. You need to know about this, folks. And also, Kerri-Anne Mendoza from The Canary, a internet newspaper based here in Bristol that's been very successful. Also, Thomas Barlow from The Real Media organisation, which is based up in Manchester. Fabio Bossi, too, takes a look at Bitcoin. And John Hardesty and I discuss the New World Order in the light of the US presidential elections. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio1word.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. You can also find us at Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. Right, well, we continue with our terrible technology. Well, it's not quite the title of what we're doing here because the technology isn't itself terrible. Sometimes it's just the way we use it or misuse it. And it's looking today at Generation Deaf. Do headphones make you deaf? And Sue Jones is joining me. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
So, do headphones make you deaf?
Well, there is evidence that they can do. And I really think this is a big thing. It's kind of an invisible thing that's going to be like the smoking of the 21st century.
Because, I mean, we're not talking about the old-fashioned headphones that you put on to listen to your old vinyl records at home. This is more those little things you stick in your ears, isn't it?
They are worse because they do increase the volume by 7 or 9 decibels compared to the ones that go over your ears.
Wow.
But any headphones can damage your hearing if it's too loud.
Well, that's right. It's much, much closer to your eardrum, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
So will deafness be the lung cancer of the 21st century? Is it really that bad?
I think it could be. I think it may not kill people, but it will certainly kill their social life, because if you've ever had an ear infection and not been able to hear people, it's no fun at all.
And so how many people are affected by this?
Well, they reckon in America that 1 in 5 teenagers have already got hearing loss. That's already
20% of teenagers.
Yes,
already.
Good. Yes,
but I mean, you know, I think from my teenage years, I can remember, you know, used to go to heavy metal concerts and things. You could see what kind of teenager I was, and we would come out with our ears ringing.
Yes, well, that's always a bad sign. If your ears are hurting or ringing, that shows that there's some damage. Now, with luck, when you've done it on a kind of one-off every now and again, then your hearing will recover. All right.
So, how do we know whether a sound level's dangerous or not?
Well, there's different levels. So I'm going to subject you to a quiz now.
Okay.
So if we're thinking about levels, now here's a clue. The level at which it becomes dangerous to hear sound at work is 85 decibels. So if the sound at work is going to be dangerous, if it's going to be 85 decibels, that you have to wear ear protectors.
So that's okay. So your boss has got to do that. But how do you measure it? Because most people are at work, they've got no idea how many
there
decibels.
There are apps you can get for your phone, which I'll talk about later.
Okay.
But let's say, so now, if 85 decibels is a sort of danger level, how loud would you say normal conversation is?
I would say 60 decibels or 50 decibels.
Well, 60. Well, aren't you clever?
Is it?
Yeah,
that was a good
60.
Guess. All right, okay.
Okay. Now let's think about a busy street with heavy traffic.
Okay, so 70.
80.
Okay.
80, so that's coming up to the danger level.
Right.
Think about a motorbike. Brum, brum.
Right, next to the motorbike, maybe even 90.
Yeah, 90, okay. 95.
Righto.
Then a pneumatic drill.
Oh, gosh, 100.
Yeah, 115.
Wow.
Way over. And then gunfire right in
your
ear.
Okay, so if you're in the army and you've got your artillery howitzer and you're just letting that off at the enemy, I would say that's probably 150 decibels.
Well, yeah, 130.
Okay.
And the highest measurement I've got is rock music at its peak at a concert would be 150.
Okay, so louder than the Royal Artillery.
Yeah.
God. Right. Okay, folks, next time you go to one of those heavy metal gigs, remember that.
Yes. Yeah, so now, how then, we've gone through those different sorts of things and how loud they are. Thinking about that then, if you've got an MP3 player or an iPod at maximum volume, and 85 is the danger level, what do you think is the maximum volume?
Well, if I was Steve Jobs or anyone at Apple or anybody else making one of these things, I'd make sure it couldn't go over 85, because then you'd be actually physically damaging your customers and you don't necessarily want to do that.
Well, I agree with you, but these players go up to 110.
No.
They go up to 110. So
that's the equivalent of, what were we just now? That's roughly someone using a pneumatic drill next to you.
Yes. Yes. In your ear. And the thing is, and the dance club, it's similar level to that. So, and the thing is, you may not realise it's as loud as that. I don't know if you've had the experience that you're in the car, you've got the radio on, and you're going through traffic, and then you stop the car, everything's quiet, and you think, God, that radio's loud. And that's because you haven't got any background noise anymore. So all of us, when we're listening to music or the radio, we turn it up if there's a lot of background noise. So if you've got earphones that let in the outside noise, you're always going to be turning the volume up to compensate for that, which is why it's an excellent idea to have headphones that are noise cancelling, and then they kind of, and especially if they're over the ear headphones, they isolate your ears and you don't have to ramp it up so much.
But we're talking mostly about these things you stick in your ears, and so many people use those nowadays, almost all the time. In fact, if you're walking around in town, the chances of you saying to someone, excuse me, the chances are they've actually got something on in their ear, maybe music or whatever.
Very, very often.
Maybe this podcast. I hope it's this podcast.
Well, hopefully they haven't got it on maximum
volume. Not too loud, folks,
yeah.
No.
Well, and this is the thing these days. People can be listening for hours a day. In the olden days, the most you could have was a Walkman, right? And you had to put a cassette in and you'd hear one side of the cassette. You'd turn it over, you'd hear the other side. After 40 minutes, it would all be over. And unless you had a stock of them, that would be your listening done for the day. Whereas now, people can have thousands of tracks on an MP3 player. They could be listening to different tracks all day, every day for weeks.
It does sort of cut people off from the community around them, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
And I suppose it makes the city more isolationist and atomises our community. But look, how does the loud music actually damage your hearing?
Yeah, right. Before I say that, there's one other little thing.
Okay.
Which, and this is a surprising thing to me, the way decibels are measured, it's not like degrees temperature. So like an extra 5 degrees hotter is the same, whether you're talking about going from 20 to 25 or 5 to 10, mm-hmm. It's all the same. It goes up logarithmically,
okay.
The decibels. So for every 3 decibels increase, you're talking about a doubling of the volume, which is huge. So if you just turn it up a little bit, the volume is actually getting much, much louder, which is why you can only cope with different levels of sound for different times. So if you've got something at 85 decibels, all right, that's at the safe level. If you've got it at 95 decibels, you should have a maximum of 4 hours a day hearing at that level. If it's 120 decibels, which is like what a pneumatic drill would be, you're talking about instant damage to your hearing. So the
hang on, so because we were talking just now about these earphone, the iPods and these various MP3 players, that they are actually at that volume. So as soon as you switch it to that volume, you could be damaging your hearing.
You could be. If you're listening to it at the maximum volume, then within a few minutes, you could be damaging your hearing permanently. And sorry, you did what you asked me before was how does it actually damage you?
Yeah.
Okay. So the sound goes into your ear and goes through your eardrum into the middle ear, which is bones, which all knock against each other. You can very highly complex this. And then it goes into the inner ear, which is full of fluid. And in that inner ear, there are something like 18,000 hair cells. And the best description is to think of these like little leaves on a tree, right? And normal sort of sounds will just make these leaves kind of just wave around a bit in the breeze, and they send the impulses up to your brain, and then you hear it. But when you've got sound that's too loud. It's like a hurricane coming through, which kind of blows the branches off the tree and damages them. And once these hair cells are damaged, they're damaged for good. You've lost your hearing. So it's, you know, it's a one-off thing.
Now, I mean, we have talked a bit about different types of headphones, ones that go right over your ears and ones you stick in your ear, this kind of thing. So does it matter what type of headphones you use?
Yes, they definitely recommend that you have ones that are on your ear or over your ear.
Not in your ear.
No.
Okay, well, that's a very good piece of advice. So,
And preferably with noise cancelling in them, so that that cuts the outside noise down, so that you're only focusing on the actual music and you don't have to keep cranking it up because of the noise outside.
So, okay, so this problem is known about. A lot of auditory surgeons or doctors have looked at this. They know it's damaging people's ears. Is there any laws, legislation governing it?
Well, this is quite interesting. In 2009, there was a class action of people trying to sue Apple, but it failed because they were saying, you know, the iPods could cause hearing loss, but they couldn't prove it had actually caused hearing loss for those particular people. So what's happened is there has been an EU directive now in 2013, which says that new MP3 players must warn listeners that levels of over 85 decibels can damage their hearing.
So on the packaging or what? So when you open it up?
I don't have an MP3 player. But
you have to buy one and find out.
I think it perhaps flashes up. But you can override it. This is the thing. You can override it. And I think at least 40% of teenagers override it regularly. So, and of course, people do. You know, they like having loud music and they don't realise the damage that they're doing. So,
and the annoyance that they're causing to those sitting around them on the train or on the bus, or even if you're in a car blasting the music out, sometimes that people, other people sitting in the traffic jam, can hear your boom, boom, boom noise, you know. But anyway, look, so what can we do to protect our hearing, Sue? Well, this is the real thing we need to know.
Yeah, the 60-60 rule is the good one to remember. So don't put the volume at more than 60% of the maximum, and only listen for 60 minutes a day at that volume, and then you'll be all right. So that's definitely will keep you safe. As I said, have headphones that aren't within the ears but that are over the ears. They are better, particularly the ones that cancel out the outside noises. A small drop in volume will reduce the loudness by a lot because of this logarithmic scale. So it's, you know, it's well worth just turning it down a little bit. If other people sitting next to you can hear your music, then that means it's too loud. If you, when you've got your headphones on, can't hear somebody speaking to you, then it's too loud. And
saying turn it down, for example.
For instance, as I have sometimes, though sometimes they turn it up.
Well, it's annoying
just
to drown you out. I mean, this is a thing. It's an interesting phenomenon socially, isn't it, really? Do you have the courage to go up to someone and say, can you please turn that music down? It's annoying me. Then all of a sudden, you have a potential confrontation. I think it's always worth doing it in a polite way just to see what the reaction is. And then maybe if you do it, someone else does it. The next day someone else does it, then maybe the person might get the message that the music's too loud and it's not just someone having a beef about it or as something personal, that it is actually annoying people.
Yes, but I think people have got to really have their own reason for turning it down. I think if it was more widely known that this is actually likely to damage their hearing, and once it's gone, it's gone.
I suppose that's the thing to do, isn't it, really, is to have a conversation with them about how it damages your hearing permanently. They probably wouldn't believe you, would they?
Or campaign to get a law in so that there is a maximum of 85 decibels on these players, and then they couldn't damage people's hearing.
I suppose the message is just turn it down a bit, isn't it, really?
Turn it down, and you can get apps. One is which is free, called Play It Down, and another one called Sound Meter Plus is £1.49. So that very cheap, and you can get apps to put on your smartphone or whatever to measure how loud it is.
Okay, and that could be used for all sorts of things, can't it? So if you think you know, you just want to know, say, for example, a neighbour at night or whatever is annoying, workmen, that kind of thing. Then you can phone up the council and say, yes, but they're making this noise opposite us. It's 120 decibels.
Well, there you go, yes.
And they'll know, oh, gosh, that's over the legal limit. Well, they'll have to send somebody around, won't they? Anyway, look, Absolutely. Sue Jones, thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect again.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Oh, it's brilliant to be here tonight, especially getting to speak in my hometown. As you can tell from my accent, I am a Bristol girl. I grew up in Kingswood, just down the road, which is a glorious place, as many of you will know. So it's actually the Canary's first birthday this week. We've just celebrated 1 year of being in existence, and goodness gracious, what an extraordinary year it's been. The Canary, I don't know if many of you will know this, the Canary actually started as a conversation at a party. I'd been writing at Script Tonight Daily for about four or five years by that point, and bemoaning the state of the UK media and why can't we do something? And then a close friend of mine said, well, why don't we? You know, what if you took sort of Script Tonight to the logical next level and created a whole outlet? And that was in 2014. And a year of conversations and planning and recruiting and building later, we launched the Canary in October of 2015. And, you know, we planned a quiet year. We thought we'd go out. You know, we started with nothing. This is the thing most people don't actually know about the Canary. We set up for significantly less than £1,000. We had no external investment, no external shareholders, no government grant, no philanthropist who kindly gave us millions of pounds to set up the outlet. We started with absolutely nothing, and we've earned every penny, every follower. We've now got over 2,000 paying subscribers who are actually paying for something they can get entirely for free. They don't get a mug, they don't get a t-shirt, just to be a part of building the new media. And I just thank each and every one of them. I think it's extraordinary that people are helping us build this new media. So what has that year looked like? Well, we'd only been running about 2 months, and there was a whole page in the Telegraph saying, the Canary is the maddest left-wing website in the world. And we were kind of like, if we're anything in the world at 2 months, we'll just take it. That was fantastic. And it's only gone up. And, you know, by the time we got to our first birthday, we'd managed to reach 14 million people. And that's 40 million hits on the website. If we weren't to grow at all in the next year, we'd be a £250,000 a year business as it stands, which means that we're now in the position, and we have been throughout the year, of paying writers a decent wage for their work. And actually developing the business model for the Canary was actually one of the most challenging things that we came up with, because what we wanted to do was essentially create a revenue share model. One of the things that really frustrates me most about the mainstream media and new media, actually, is you're expected to do it for the love of it. And while that's great that we're passionate and people are willing to give their time and their energy for free, you know, a lot of what we're railing against in the new media is unwaged labour. You know, it's workfare, it's, you know, poor terms and conditions. We didn't want to replicate that. So what we wanted to do was make sure that the writers and the editors actually share in the growth of the business. And that's why we created a business model which is based on a revenue share. But because of the number of people that are now subscribing to the Canary, it means that we can also offer a flat fee per article, which is really important to us. So nobody's working for free at all. They know that at the very least they're going to get their minimum fee per article, and then they can earn more based on the other avenues of income that we've got. And the other question that we wanted to answer was, how do you fund long-form investigative journalism inside that model? How does that work? So what we did for the whole first year, and what we'll do ongoingly, is actually holding back 5% of everything that we earn and creating a pot called the Investigative Journalism Fund, which our writers can then bid to. So they put in a pitch and say, I want to do this, that or the other. And we're now in the position on the 27th that we're actually going to have our first writer benefit from that fund. We've got a writer in our global section called Brad Hoff, who's heading to Syria to actually produce stories on the ground from Syria, video, written articles, completely original journalism, completely funded ourselves without seeking any external investment. I mean, hugely proud of that. And good luck, Brad. Not an easy gig. So Brad's off. And we now just launched Canary Media 2.0, which is moving closer to the vehicle that we want to be ongoing, which is a regular news programme. So if you're a fan of The Young Turks, think of a British version of The Young Turks, a really irreverent regular news programme that kind of breaks down the key stories of the week or the month into a news programme for people to digest, and also create an incredible new platform for video bloggers, because we have so many incredible video bloggers in this country, and having a place where people can see them frequently is really, we can shine a light, use our audience, our big audience, to benefit those people is great. But people often say, well, what are you most proud of? And, you know, we're really proud of the reach that we've had. We're really proud that we've got a business model that's sustainable. That's all lovely. But actually, the thing I've been most proud of in this year is the team that we've built. I've never worked anywhere in my life. I've worked in the private sector, the public sector, you know, in blogging and other fields, and I've never been in a workplace that felt so much like home, that had people really working together as a tight unit, that really stand for each other, that pull together. We have a virtual online newsroom rather than an office, but people can still see each other and work together. And the way that the writers actually kind of collaborate with each other on stories is absolutely extraordinary. There's none of this kind of me, you know, hogging of the stories. If a story's pitched by a writer and someone else has been working behind the scenes on something, they'll hand over their research, you know, and say, please take this, I just want your story to be better. And that's been really great. And I think what I'd probably close with is one of the metrics for success that we had when we launched the Canary was that we don't want to be a new media version of the Murdoch empire. We're not empire building. We're proving a concept. We're proving that anyone can do this. And often, you know, when you get to the sort of prominence that we are now, it's, you know, people, as they should, will point out what we're doing wrong and, you know, well, if I was in your position, I'd be doing this or that. And my answer to them is really, really simple. Do it. Like, if you think you can do this better, please do it. Because what we need in our media is to rapidly expand it, to have a diversity of voices, to have a diversity of editorial opinion and line. And that was why one of our metrics of success was actually if in 2 or 3 years' time, not only is the Canary itself thriving, but we've generated 50 other Canaries, that other groups of bloggers, other groups of independent journalists, video bloggers are getting together and going, hang on a minute, they did this with nothing. They did this without a penny of investment. We can do this too. And that way, instead of, you know, the situation we've been in for so long, which is looking at the failure of traditional media in terms of the narrowness of the topics covered, what they miss, what they misreport, and complaining, we're now in a position where we can proactively do something about it. And I think that's absolutely thrilling. I'm so proud and feel really privileged and honoured to be a part of that. And certainly I'm really, really excited about the next year and being able to launch these new channels in video and audio and expand and reach ever more people. So I'm not going to take up any more time on this section and like the other speakers to speak. I think the only thing I would close on is saying that I don't view these people here as competitors. I see them as teammates in building a new media. And one of the things that I find so refreshing about this new media space is that we're willing to promote each other's work, have each other's back, celebrate each other's successes as if they were our own. And again, Sam isn't here, but really, Media Diversified are doing absolutely extraordinary work. They're one of my favourite outlets. So unfortunately, Sam can't be here tonight to bang the drum for that outlet, so I'm going to do it on her behalf. If you haven't checked it out already, absolutely do, because they're awesome. And ditto these guys and girls. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's me, it's Tom Marlowe from Real Media. Let me just wipe my talk. Right. So, I guess I wanted to split up what I was going to say into three sections as well. I wanted to talk about, just very quickly, about what the problems are with the media as it currently exists. And I think someone else has done the work better than me, so talk about that. And then talk a little bit about real media and what it has done and what it's doing. But then also talk about, I think, the challenges that remain for all of the new media and for the media generally. As a member of the NUJ, I think we should talk about workers' rights and workers' conditions within the media as well. I think that's important. So, in terms of problems with the media, there's a couple of people you might have heard of them, Noam Chomsky and Edward S. Herman, who did something called, did a book called Manufacturing Consent, and in it they outline a theory that's called the five filters theory. It says there's five filters between you and the information you get about the world through the media. And those filters are the ownership of the media. We know that 80% of the press is owned by five billionaires. We know that 70% of TV and radio news is owned by the state through the BBC. So ownership is important. Funding is important. Advertising is the way that most... The licence fee is the BBC, but the BBC's licence fee isn't separate from government, so we know that that's a state organisation. And advertisers basically pay for the paper. Papers are sold to advertisers, not to you and me. And what we pay for the paper doesn't even pay for the paper that it's printed on, not even close. So multinational advertisers will want their interests represented. I think the most significant example of this recently is the Conservative commentator Peter Oborne, who's the political editor of The Telegraph, leaving The Telegraph because he couldn't report on HSBC because they were doing a serious sponsorship of The Telegraph. I mean, this is a direct impact, but mostly this is something that journalists internalise. They know who their owners are, they know who their advertisers are. You know that before you go and work for The Daily Mail or The Sun or The Guardian, even. And then we've got the pressures of what Nick Davis calls churnalism, which is the pressure to release as much as you can, as quickly as you can, and fact-check as little as possible, so, because it takes time. So you fact-check. You don't have to fact-check things that come from think tanks or from government sources, but you do have to fact-check what people like you and me send. So they'll take think tanks all day, and that's why the Institute for Economic Affairs and Migrant Watch and so forth have front pages every single day. In fact, 80% of everything you read in the press is written by PR companies, which, of course, used to be PR, public relations, used to be called propaganda, but in a swift move of propaganda, they changed the name to PR. And then it's a pretty genius move. I think we need some of those guys on our side. Then you also have the mobilisation of fear and patriotism, and you also have the fear that journalists have from being sued, and papers have been sued, which is a fear of the rich. It's not you and I. You and I, we don't have the resources to sue a paper successfully, but, you know, Max Mosley does, you know. And all of those types. The City of London does. That's why we have Benefit Street, we don't have Bankers Street. As much as anything else, it's a fear of reprisals. So, recognising all of that, actually let me talk about what are the problems for new media. New media faces similar pressures, not from ownership, not from advertising, largely. New media will usually, like ourselves, ban advertising or do it in the most ethical possible way. We don't push patriotism usually, though there are obviously new media outlets that do that. There's also conspiracy theory outlets that do bizarre pushing of the lizard propaganda. But lizard man propaganda, but that's probably by the by. I think the key problem that we have that is both faced in the mainstream press, the mass media, and in the new media is... what Nick Davis calls churnalism, the need to turn out copy, the need to fact check. It is expensive to fact check. It takes time, it takes resources, it takes skill. We're either going to have quality journalism that comes from the new media, or, as we get currently from the new media, a lot of what we do is commentary. We cannibalise work that has been done by other journalists, by the Press Association and so forth, and we comment on it. We bring you a different spin, we utilise it to tell you a different story. But new media doesn't have the resources to do proper journalism, nor does mainstream journalism. Just today, the BBC announced it's looking to lay off 300 staff in its news department. BuzzFeed is losing money. Daily Mail is losing, its profits are going down. The Sun has been losing so much money for years that if Murdoch wasn't around, it would have been sold off and maybe even shut down a long time ago. That we're all facing the same financial pressures. What Kerry-Anne pointed out that is an opportunity for new media is we're not competing with each other. We may not have multi-billion pound benefactors, but we can work together. We can do what lefties and progressives have always talked about, which is we can cooperate. And I believe that's through having strong unionised workplaces, and I think it's through founding cooperatives and networking those cooperatives. I think that's the way forward for new media to try and meet those pressures. But I think something we've got to do in an age where everything is free is engage with our readership and reach a larger readership, reach beyond the people we usually reach, because we are often preaching to the choir. But not only that, we need to engender a recognition that this is something worth supporting. It's not just worth supporting, it's worth being part of. Funding is, it shouldn't be just a transactional process of saying, here you go, here's some of my money, here's, it's, I'm giving you some of my labour time. I've spent an hour, earning £8.50, and I'm going to give you half an hour of that each week to make the media a better place. And I'm going to, and with that, I want control, a little bit of control, a little bit of say over what you're doing. And I'm doing it because this is how we, as people, work together and change society. And that, I think, is hugely important, is we need to come up with a way all of us together start talking about this to our readers, and not just say, hey, we need money, real media needs money, Canary needs money. You know, it's the all elements of our society, especially, including the media, but not only the media, need us to start looking at things not in an individualistic way, but in a societal way, where we start saying, do you know what? Society isn't dead. We're going to come together. We're going to build institutions. We're going to build our own houses. We're going to build our own energy. We're going to build our own media. And I think we start with the media because it helps every other section. Someone who's a long-term activist in all of those other areas, I realise if we don't have control and ownership over the information that we're sharing with society, then society cannot make informed decisions. It cannot support all these other projects. So I think if you're in an energy project, a housing project, if you're in political campaigns, if you're in a trade union, you need to support new media because no one else is going to tell your story. No one else is going to give it the support that it needs. So this is something I think is really important to communicate, and it's what I hope people in this room will communicate with us. I hope when we produce these videos, we'll share them with people and you'll say, yes, guys, we need to take control of our media. We need to own it. We need to run it. We need to support something new. And this is the way that we're going to build a new and better world, because I think if anything, if we've seen, learned anything from the Brexit debate, is that the media is not capable of informing useful public debate. It's rational public debate at all. And yet, I'm a Democrat, and I hope most people in this room are Democrats, you know, who believe in people making decisions in society. Well, how are we going to do that when we don't trust the sources we get, and for good reason? When we don't trust experts, and for good reason? We need to build a new and better media. I'll finish on that. Thank you. Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Fabio Bossi. I'm a German citizen with an Italian name. I'm 40 years old. I'm a former global fund manager. I worked in that company from 2001 until 2011. And I got into Bitcoin in 2011 when a good friend of mine told me about this money and was all excited about it. And as a adherent to the Austrian School of Economics, I was sympathetic to the idea of girls' money, but no coder or hacker or programmer. I'm just, when it comes to computers, I'm just a simple user. And so I was highly skeptical about this money, but when he tried to explain it to me as digital gold, the first digital gold in the sense that Bitcoin is the first digital entity that has ever been created that cannot be copied.
Now, hang on, because the whole point of gold is it's something physical and real. You can hold it in your hand, you can stick it under your mattress, you can put it in a safe. But Bitcoin, of course, is not. It's a kind of bit of digital code that's going up and down your connection on the internet.
True. But the idea of if you think about, because for an Austrian, when we say, well, gold is money, an Austrian, at least, I don't want to talk for all Austrian economists. It's my personal interpretation of it. When I say it, I mean gold is a good money. It's not the best. To me, it's a pretty good money. And the attributes, there are many that are very similar. The difference is the physical. You can't touch it. You're right there, but. Bitcoin has also advantages because you can send it almost instantly and with very low cost from here to there. And the code is based on consensus because there is no scientific or definitive economic reason why even gold is worth anything. We as human beings have gotten used to it by 3,000 years. And Bitcoin is designed as digital gold, and one, the idea that this non-multipliable digital token is still there. It's the network is still growing, and people start to accept, hey, Bitcoin, it's actually working and worth something.
Many people would say that there are problems with the existing financial system. We're talking about, for example, the IMF. And the World Bank, and in fact all our central banks and our private banks. I mean, at the moment, there are big questions over Deutsche Bank. Everybody thought this bank is one of the safest in the world. So what is wrong with the money system?
I didn't. I stopped shorting Deutsche Bank 2 years ago because I was getting tired of it.
What is wrong with the existing financial system?
Well, first of all, it's based on government force. There is no free choice. There is no liberty. It's corporatism. To me, big banks and big government is like a Siamese twins. Well, that's the root problem. And the practical problems, of course, are we have a debt money system. And Bitcoin and gold and basically the opposite because it's an asset money, not a debt-based money. The modern economists are the mainstream or whatever. If you really dig into, well, what money even is, those guys, they're talking about moneyness because they can't even define what money is because it's a whole complicated mess about, well, they mix up different types of claims on money with money itself and they try to know what money actually is. Now we are talking about moneyness and swap lines and whatever, and nobody knows anymore what money is, and they want to abolish. We sheeple are to abandon every right. And as an Austrian, it's sad to even have to beg for cash because it's the best money you can get, the paper money from the government, because at least it has only the central bank as a default risk, as opposed to if you put the same on Deutsche Bank. So it's such a ridiculous, primitive, oppressive, authoritarian, anti-free market, anti-liberty money system, and that's why Satoshi Nakamoto, the founder of Bitcoin, It's very likely, well, he directed Bitcoin again established money system. And he designed Bitcoin to be close to, at least how I understand it, and it is designed that way, and there are other people confirming it. And again, the attributes, you, for instance, your favorite song on MP3 is worth something to you. Like maybe your favorite song, you'd maybe pay £1 for to get it. Once you get it, once you have it, you could multiply it by 1,000. You could, an MP3 file could never be used as money. If you have a digital entity that can get lost, so it can't be copied, and it has solved a long-standing logical problem, the Byzantines generals problem. I won't get too deep into that because again, I'm not a cryptographer, etc. Yeah, that's how I got into Bitcoin in 2011, and the whole sector grows since then, and it's gotten larger and has attracted bright young and then very enthusiastic and lots of libertarians, what I like, of course, as a libertarian myself.
So what about the next few years? Is obviously quite a few problems in the European financial system and in the United States, many parts of the world. Where do you see things, the mainstream financial system going, especially with the news we've had of Deutsche Bank being big question marks over that?
When it comes to the financial system, or however you want to call it, it's I'm a kind of agnostic when it comes to that. Chuck Prince said it best, the former CEO of Citibank, right before in 2007. I don't know the exact quote anymore, but he, you know, the people, how that game play, when they dance around the chairs and when the music stops.
Yeah, musical chairs.
The central banks of the world are, since the financial crisis, in a constant, desperate attempt to keep the music playing. And we don't know how long that can go, because they have learned from the almost meltdown in 2008. They have swap lines and blah, blah, blah. So when it comes to Deutsche Bank, I don't even know if any expert can really answer the question is if Deutsche Bank is... Because it depends on much psychology and politics. So when I was a fund manager, and I was a fund of fund managers, so I actually talked to fund managers, and I met many fund managers who had just stopped even trading or investing in bank stocks, because they all said we simply don't understand it anymore. We don't know how to value it.
It sounds amazing that someone would invest a lot of money into something and yet not understand anything much about that organization, whether it's still going to be there in a week's time. Is that really a casino?
The global financial system is so complex that casino would be... There are many casino aspects, but I wouldn't call the global financial system a casino.
Getting back to Bitcoin, having a look at it, there seems to be quite a lot of secrecy. One would have hoped that with an alternative system to the mess that we've got with the international financial system as it is, that the only way that an alternative to it would be successful was if the people who constructed it were completely open about how it was constructed and, for example, who they were. But that isn't really the case with Bitcoin, is it? So why the secrecy?
What do you mean? Who is secret in Bitcoin?
Okay, so who controls it? Who is in charge of Bitcoin?
The shortest answer would be the Bitcoin crowd. I mean, it's an ecosystem made of miners, full nodes, trade holders, Bitcoin exchanges, the whole altcoin universe. Altcoins are alternative.
How safe is it if people were thinking about investing in Bitcoin? How safe is it?
Define safe.
Would it retain its value?
Measured in pound or gold or oil or...
Well, yeah. I mean, any of those things.
Well, I don't want to express any opinion on the pound, but I'm pretty... pretty optimist for Golden Oil.
Yeah, so you think it would, with, you know, in compared to Golden Oil?
Those are good comparisons. The biggest difference between gold, let's focus on gold and Bitcoin, is the possibility of a sudden death. Because as far as I understand it, again, I'm no technical expert, if you have 51% of the so-called hash rate of the Bitcoin network, which is extremely large, bigger than Google something when they put together all their servers or stuff like that. And again, Petahash make a huge computer network with mines doing the cryptographic calculations to secure that Bitcoin network. And if you put a lot of money in those supercomputers and you had 51% the hash power, you could alter the code in a way, and in theory, you could thus auto-destruct the system. So a government, but a really completely rogue, completely insane government prepared to waste incredible amounts of money just to kill Bitcoin, because they would only try. It's not even, it's a theory. So, and but it's a bit like, with gold, well, could the government confiscate gold? Yeah, well, yes, certainly it could. It already has in many countries over the. It's forbidden in many countries today. So that's why I ask for a definition of safe, because there are no 100% safe havens. There never have been, probably. If you want to hold cash, or the idea of money, the idea, well, you were born in Britain, so money for you is the pound. Well, I pound for me is worthless. I don't hold any pounds. Can't do anything with pounds, and I have no particular confidence in the pound. You don't have any particular confidence in the euro, I guess. And we both wouldn't like to hold the dollar. We are even among the luckiest people in the world, because there are so many people in the world who hold even shittier, worse paper money. So there is a huge market for that, but I probably wouldn't express that in the way that I do it talking with you, but you kind of have to deprogram people. Think, how would you like your money to be?
What about you? Government. I mean, you were as a fund manager. Why did you quit?
I didn't quit, actually. I was quitted.
You were sacked?
Yes, I was sacked.
So is that because you weren't making enough money? What was the reason?
My version of the story, for I've never thought about. Maybe it's has some little implication, but my version of the story is, and I can actually prove it, and I have witnesses, etc. But my boss didn't like being pointed at the fact that he wasn't a particularly gifted asset manager.
Okay, so basically, if you've got some young man who's or woman who's an intelligent fund manager, watch out, your boss might feel threatened by you.
I think those phenomena can be observed in every field, or stuff like that can happen to you in a lawyer's firm or in a hospital. So that's not particularly specific for the financial market.
No, well, it's nice to hear that the same sort of thing goes on in Germany as goes on here. Anyway, Fabio, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're welcome.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hi, I'm John Hardesty. So the US presidential election is imminent. And on the back of the dollar bill, we have the eye and the pyramid. So this is allegedly the sign of the New World Order. Is it really the New World Order or not? So here's Dialect's Tony Gosling, New World Order or not, Tony?
Well, I think yes. Actually, I think it is a New World Order. I mean, in a way, it's been put on the Great Seal of the United States on the back. The idea is you look at the Great Seal on the front and you see a picture of George Washington or whoever it is. But this is the sort of hidden side of America. And I think that's where it comes from. Also, if you go onto your dollar and have a look, you'll see in Latin, it says announcing the birth of a new secular order. Now, this was a symbol which was around about the same time as America was born in Germany. A society called the Illuminati was founded, which attempted to bring together all of the Freemason associations right across Europe into one organization, calling it the Illuminati, and then having some kind of connection, although this is, you know, difficult to fathom, with the United States. And there is some really good research on this, but it's not the more recent stuff that I would point people to. It's the stuff from the Times. The late 1700s were a fascinating time. They were calling it the Enlightenment, and this was a time where technology was breaking through, new things like the steam engine, the Industrial Revolution was all starting. And one of the people who was the leaders of that whole revolution was this guy, John Robison. Robison was a secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh, and they were basically running a lot of these new inventions and running them out and creating industries out of them. And he wrote a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe. And it really was a description of what had been happening with the beginning of this group, the Illuminati. He was a Freemason himself. He was a close friend of James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine. And he saw what was happening with the Illuminati in Germany and the United States as something which was actually terrible for Freemasonry. He loved Freemasonry. He thought it was a great thing. And at the time, you know, it's probable that it was. And so he could see that being destroyed. And this is effectively, I think, why it's a new secular order. The idea being that, I mean, basically, Freemasonry is a deist cult. It's a religious cult, and it's deist, which means you talk about God a lot, but you don't actually believe in God, effectively.
Okay, so put simply, what is the New World Order?
A bit more simply than that, it's effectively, it's a kind of running things from behind the scenes in the shadows, like the Wizard of Oz. So you're not really quite sure who's running things. You're seeing things. I mean, we had a thing on this program last week with the guy we interviewed was the nephew of one of the directors of the Bank of England. And he said to his nephew, Justin Walker, he said, well, the Bank of England actually controls all the politicians and the press. Don't believe anything you read in the press because the money people control it. And that's effectively what we're dealing with the New World Order. The government, for example, in Italy was discovered to have been running, being run by P2 Masonic Lodge for decades, where it didn't really matter who the people voted for. It was the chiefs of police, the heads of the secret services, the editors of the owners of the newspapers, the big bankers in Italy that were running the whole show. And I think effectively that's what it's like here in Britain. It's a kind of Masonic government behind the scenes, coordinated internationally. But, you know, we don't realise, I think, that much of what is given to us through the press, through the media, we think these things just happen. Actually, a lot of them, I think, are cooked up behind the scenes. George Bush Sr. mentioned the New World Order when in the invasion of Kuwait was announced back in 1990. And that effectively was, I think, you know, where this came out into the open. As soon as we were, you know, in the 1990s, the 2000s, then we had, of course, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that there is an attempt to effectively go into the Middle East, and which is the cradle of civilization, and create this kind of new world order, a new world system, starting in the cradle of civilization, started effectively by the Americans.
And so when we say this new world order, what does that look like?
It looks like the pyramid, which is a structure with one or two people at the top controlling everything. And they've been, I think, doing this for years, for centuries, for even maybe thousands of years behind the scenes. Now, I suppose with the internet and things like that, we're starting to see what's been going on all those centuries. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sue Jones. looking at headphones and how they can make you deaf. Also, Kerri-Ann Mendoza, editor of The Canary, and Thomas Barlow from Real Media in Manchester. Also, Fabio Bossi, a fan of Bitcoin. I'm not, I must add. And John Hardesty and I discussing the New World Order. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch up with us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. You can volunteer here or lots of other places through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online there, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or you can go to the National Volunteering website at do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.